Hello, and welcome to the second podcast in our series on PPS payment reform with the RCS1 model hosted by the Health Services Division. In our first podcast, we went over the major highlights of RCS1 and the changes that were posed in the research model that was released in the 2017 Advance Notice of Proposed Rule. So if you haven't checked that out, stop here, listen to that one first, because this one won't really make sense without that background. In today's podcast, we're going to review more specific details about the planned payment components of the daily patient rate, as well as discuss some proposed timelines and really how to prepare. As we had mentioned in the last cast, the daily patient rate is posed to convert from a therapy utilization-driven model to a more patient-centered model. This rate will be based off specific resident characteristics and their unique comorbidities. The payments will be broken out into five components or categories that would make up your daily patient rate. So that's right, five different components, where we're currently at three. So first, let's take a look at the first component, which is a combination of physical and occupational therapy services. The PT-OT reimbursement would be combined under RCS1 and would be based on the summation of three different categories. The first is a clinical category that relates to the acute inpatient diagnosis for which the patient is being admitted to the SNF. Therapy would then assign a second functional category that would be a scored methodology based off three ADL self-performance activities: eating, transfers, and toileting. Therapy then adds in a third category score, which is a cognitive status score based off the well-known industry cognitive functional status assessment. Then they summarize those three category scores and then assigns the patient into one of 30 different PT and OT case mix categories. Hope this doesn't sound too complicated, because there are four more components to the rate. The next category would be for speech services. So here, the patient will be assigned a case mix score in a very similar manner to PT and OT. But the difference with speech is that there will only be two clinical categories to assign the patient instead of five. And there's an additional speech score based on the presence of swallowing deficits or a mechanically altered diet. So these two scores are then added to a speech cognitive score that includes more than PT and OT, and that it also looks at the presence of very specific speech comorbidities like vents, trachs, CVAs, or ALS, for example. So that total score for these categories then assigns the patient into one of 18 speech case mix categories. The third component of your daily rate then comes from the nursing score. And this score is going to remain pretty consistent with the current RUGS-4 methodology and would assign the patient into one of 43 non-rehab case mix groups. So similar to PPS, the score is based on their ADL score, the presence of extensive services, the presence of a specific condition, and then the use of restorative nursing. The fourth component is going to be the non-case mix items like room and board, which we all know will be very market-based. And then the fifth component of the rate would be for NTA or non-therapy ancillary costs like medication. So if you recall, the research project found that with a few exceptions in medical devices, that certain comorbidities and extensive services were highly predictive of the relative differences in patient costs. So the NTA portion of the daily rate would be a score that's based off the admitting diagnosis, the costliness of those comorbidities, and their age. So through this weighted methodology, CMS felt that they could account for the differences in medication costs across different diagnoses and across different comorbidities. So that NTA score would then assign the patient into one of 27 case mix categories that indicates a level of intensity of medication costs that assigns a tier. And those tiers range from low to ultra high. So finally, if you take all five of those component scores, you end up with a daily per diem rate that gets adjusted based on the date of the stay, like we discussed in the first cast. So that reimbursement is then overlaid with sequestration, SNF value-based purchasing incentives or reductions, you've got your SNF quality reporting program penalties, and any market basket increases. So this would leave us with up to over 139,000 different daily payment options per patient day. So not as simple as they hope to make it, right? The model has therefore left many providers with a lot of questions. And from the industry's intense study of the research, a host of potential implications to providers and patient care arose. So on the provider side, CMS predicts that those SNFs who are less than 50 beds are nonprofit or government-based facilities or swing bed facilities, or even SNFs who admit more highly clinically complex patients will see an uptick in their revenue. In addition, SNFs posed to benefit financially in this model are those who deliver minimal rehab and who have a length of stay of less than 15 days. Now, remember, this is supposed to be a budget-neutral plan. So the opposite was said to be true of larger for-profit SNFs who tend to take a high volume of patients with intensive rehab needs, those being on three disciplines, and who have a length of stay of greater than 31 days. So with the way the model is set up currently, you can see that there's significant concern that having a significant change in a patient's condition after day 14, when payment drops substantially, remember we talked about how that it's a tiered effect sort of in the first cast, and that condition doesn't change their clinical category for reimbursement, that it could cause the inability to provide the same level of adequate care or even more care because you're providing less reimbursement. The reimbursement starts on day 14. So the model is predicted to present some challenges, I think, to patient care as well. There's some fear amongst our ancillary service providers that the provision of therapy services may decrease in this model to increase SNF margins. Since payment is solely based on the clinical diagnosis and other unique characteristics of care, there's no real measure to depict how much therapy is appropriate and how much therapy those needs correlate to. The model also has limitations in the concept of therapy minimums and patients who have had more than one major clinical diagnosis. So with the MDS changes, there would be no direct way to ensure the adequate provision of therapy services without having those threshold minimums, without measuring readmissions for those therapy patients, or without monitoring the modes of therapy service delivery, such as group, concurrent, things like that. So I think there's continued concern about the potential for this model to increase return to hospital rates because of both the potential redirection of care away from therapy and the incentive to admit more clinically complex patients with multiple nursing needs. The research of the model finds that the payment for therapy services to SNFs is a little too conservative since the therapy costs are mostly labor related, right? So experts who have really delved into this model believe that there's insufficient requirements and reimbursement for things such as respiratory therapy. So while costs are said to have been factored into reimbursement for certain respiratory conditions, there are not, for example, any respiratory comorbidity factors for patients who are on a PT and OT case, but not speech. So you can see where there would be a difference there. OPT and OT see many patients who have secondary comorbidities or respiratory diagnoses that may not have a speech need. The model also doesn't appear to align with the five-star requirements, with our SNF value-based purchasing metrics, the Impact Act, MACRA, or any of our BCPI bundled programs. And in the CMS open door forums with providers, they admit that the contractor that they hired to do the research felt that aligning this model with other industry initiatives was out of their scope, and therefore it wasn't done. There are concerns amongst providers as it relates to the MDS and the use of Section G over the Section GG factors, because this misalignment focuses mostly on late loss ADLs. And then you have the issue of predicted financial outcomes. And when CMS ran fiscal year 2014 claims data through this model, which is what we received when this came out, it was felt that it really skewed the predictions of profits and losses for SNFs, who may now have a different case mix of patients, especially with the introduction of ICD-10. There is a drastic reduction in the reimbursement for medications for diagnoses like HIV and AIDS, to the point where it's believed that the reimbursement won't even cover the cost of those medications. So the model also doesn't explain what would happen to SNF reimbursement if costly medications were added to the patient's plan of care that didn't require a significant change. Remember, a significant change is the only thing that you can do to reset payment once the patient is admitted. Software developers, they also have voiced significant concern about immediate implementation of this model due to the complexity and the time it would take to modernize their EMR and MDS software. I think providers are also concerned about the cost of those upgrades. Additionally, I think it was predicted that changes to the Medicare program would obviously affect state Medicaid programs. I think it's known historically to do that. Therapy providers are also poised to see a drastic reduction in their revenue. So it's also anticipated as a result, there will be a lesser demand for on-site therapy staff. So how is LCS currently addressing this? Our health services division is behind the scenes. We're looking into the outcomes that CMS proposed with the model, which currently show an overall reduction in revenue to life care services skilled nursing facilities by $1.6 million annually. In the many months post the release of the research and the advance notice, providers have been analyzing the data and coming up with new concerns and new questions on the advance notice all the time. Many companies, providers, and ancillary vendors both in the SNF space have varying opinions on the actual revenue increase or decrease the SNF industry will see. Some believe that the model was underestimated and that it would increase costs to Medicare, while others believe that the CMS predictions of less cost to Medicare and less revenue to SNFs were actually a little more accurate. So on the flip side, I think there's some positive changes that we need to reflect on. When you change from PPS to this type of model, where it's very patient-centered, despite the lack of the clarity on many of the processes we just talked about. So the fact that RCS 1 really focuses on patient diagnoses, comorbidities, and takes into all the clinical characteristics, age, diagnoses, the acute inpatient stay, prior level of function. It no longer places emphasis of payments on rehab intensity, but it looks rather at that clinical complexity and the cognition of the patient, which I think is excellent. So we're going to continue to monitor this research and speak with industry associations and lobbyists about the timing of implementation of the model. The answer is that it's just currently all guesswork and that no one really knows. It's just believed that it will happen at some point in the near future. So the best thing we can do to ensure that we're ahead of the curve and really developing a strategy for implementation when this does arrive is to begin to educate and prepare your teams. Because RCS1 is going to fundamentally change the way we do business today, we really need to start by doing some internal homework related to your specific case mix, the type of diagnoses you see or maybe that you want to see, what those relative costs are to you and the costs to Medicare, so your revenue from those patients, and then their average length of stay. And really begin to sit down with your therapy partner and review their RCS1 tools that they've created to provide a clearer and more up-to-date picture of your case mix reimbursement under the model. Did a lot of great work on their tools. We are working with them on some pilot communities. And when we get this information, we like to pull everybody together and have a call and kind of walk through it. We're going to start to do this more and more with different communities as we start to learn more about the implementation timeline. But CMS also provided some calculation worksheets for MDS coordinators to begin to practice the new MDS calculations as well. So there's a lot of tools out there that we can start to use to really kind of get a feel and also have an opinion on some questions that we may have. And then you're going to start to tie all this homework that you've done into your overall clinical and financial outcomes so that you can identify the opportunities that may exist from what you find. So you need to make sure that you're researching your potential unexpected costs for this implementation, like software enhancements, maybe ancillary service provider pricing changes, and like other interoperability modernizations. You want to get as much training as you can to prepare. The second phase of prep would come after the rule is announced and we know more of what to expect in terms of timing. And here's where you lay the groundwork and start the development phase of the plan that would include navigation strategies for diagnosis-specific clinical pathways and really managing length of stay in accordance with your case mix. Make sure that you really have an expert ICD-10 coder. Remember that therapy reimbursement is going to steadily decline after day 14, so make sure we're factoring this into our clinical pathway. You want to work with your health and wellness navigation program and therapy programs to tailor your clinical protocols into a marketing and cost management strategy so you're ready really to hit the ground running. Internally, I think we're also preparing to assist communities to the change by formulating a task force that's going to focus on evaluating operational strategies and different service delivery models. That includes looking at your contract pricing and options for ancillary service providers. We've asked our therapy partners to pilot those RCS1 calculators I just talked about into a crosswalk in some of our communities so we can take a more intimate and current look at coding and reimbursement with current case mix. And obviously, we also want them to look at opportunities and ways to retain meaningful staff. You know, if we're expecting a decrease in the amount of therapists we're going to need, how do we pick the cream of the crop? How do we really hone in on those therapists that get the best clinical outcomes for patients? And as always, our health services team is here to assist with questions and concerns, and of course, want to hear your feedback and good ideas for us to share and consider. We look forward to working with our communities on this next challenge while looking for enhanced ways to provide fantastic service to patients. So thanks for listening.
Legal disclaimer. Life Care Services LLC is not engaged in rendering legal advice. Therefore, any information provided in this podcast, although intended to be correct, is also not intended to replace or supersede the advice of your legal counsel. Also, thank you to Ben Sounds for the music provided in this podcast.